13 years and I was preaching for a congregation part-time. But at the company where I worked, we accumulated what was known as personal hours. I mean, you've got vacation every year, and you also accumulated so many personal hours. And I've never been one, when I get some time built up, just to blow it, I would take vacation, because if you didn't take it, you would lose it. But we would accumulate personal hours. And anyway, when I was hired at the job I'm at now, I had accumulated over 6 weeks' time of personal time. And when I give the notice where I quit, I give them 2 weeks' notice, but I also wanted to get the personal time that I had. And so 2 weeks when I give them my notice, I talked to my manager, and we went up and saw the general manager of the store. He was just a fill-in because their actual general manager had been replaced or transferred. And anyway, I give them my notice, and I wanted my 6 weeks' personal time. And you know, really, companies have to pay you your vacation, but they don't really have to pay the personal time. But anyway, I went up and I sat down and started talking to a guy named George. And we started talking, and he was acting general manager, and he didn't know, really know what to do. And then we went into personnel, and we was talking to a gal named Violet, and she was really, she knew the book, really proficient at what she did. So George says, here's what we're going to do. She says, we're going to give you your 2 weeks vacation, plus we're going to pay you we're going to pay you the rest of this week. It was like a Wednesday. We'll pay you 2 weeks vacation plus 2 weeks personal time. And then Violet says, listen, she says, Walter, you know, you're giving a notice. She says, but you're free to leave. Go back in the meat market, get your knives, go clean out your locker, and get out of here. You're free to go. And anyway, so I went and got my knives. And she says, don't tell anybody what you're doing. So I went and got my knives and cleaned out my locker, and I left. Now, any time that anyone would clean out their locker in the middle of the day, that's pretty well an indication that something bad has happened, like they got fired or something. But anyway, I wasn't fired, and I was even rehired, but I got my knives and all, and I left. And I didn't go home until like 6 o'clock that night. It was 8 hours from that morning, and at the time I didn't have a cell phone, but I had a regular landline, and I had some voice messages. And it completely caught me by surprise, and I picked up the phone. And anyway, I had like 4 or 5 messages. And anyway, I can't repeat what the messages said, but they'd start out and says, hey, Walter, we heard you really bleep bleep at Violet and called her bleep bleep this and that and all and screamed and yelled and everything else. And this went on like 5 telephone calls of that. And none of them were the same. And the point I'm trying to make is this. This happened at 10 o'clock that morning is when I finally left. By 6 o'clock that night, 8 hours later, what actually happened in people's accounting of what happened wasn't anywhere in the same ballpark. It was just amazing how they blew it out of proportion. And I said all that to say this. When you look at your Bible, the events recorded in the Bible, the New Testament goes back 2,000 years ago, the Old Testament, what, it had been 4,000? His writings?
Yeah.
Okay. When we get our Bibles out and we start reading, are the events we're reading there, are they the actual events that happened, or through the process of them being translated and passed on from generation to generation, are we just getting partial truths? You see what happened with me in a period removed of 8 hours, what actually happened and what people say happened. When we look at our Bible and when you start trying to talk with people, maybe neighbors or someone you're trying to convert, many times what's one of the first smoke screens they throw up? Well, the Bible, how do you know it's accurate? It's written thousands of years ago and it's been passed on, it's been translated and all this. How do we know it's accurate? Pretty good question, really. And so what we're going to do the next 4 weeks or so, we're going to look at the Bible, how we received it, what books are included in it, those tests that these books have to pass to be included, and especially what you call the canon of the Bible, or the canon of the New Testament. How do we know it's accurate, and how do we know that we can trust it? Now, if God can't communicate his message to us, I mean, he really can't hold us accountable. So it comes back, if he hasn't given us his word in an understandable form, then there's no way that he can hold us accountable, okay, unless it's accurate. Now, we're going to begin by looking at Revelation. And there's two types, not the book of Revelation, but Revelation. How God reveals things to us. We'll look, first of all, tonight, probably at general revelation. And then there's also what we would call special revelation. Okay, we'll start by looking at that. But you guys may have heard of the famous Swedish filmmaker named Ingmar Bergman. Supposedly one night he was listening to some stereo music. And while he was listening to the music on the stereo, he went to sleep. And when he went to sleep, he had a dream. And in this dream, he was in a cathedral, and he went up to a picture of Christ on the wall. And Christ was sitting there just looking at him. And he looked at this picture, and he says, "Speak to me, speak to me." And of course, the picture didn't speak. And anyway, he was somewhat skeptical about religion and all to begin with. And so anyway, later that year, he filmed a movie called The Silence. And the movie was supposedly about people who were seeking or following or seeking after God, but could never find Him. And I believe today, the reason most people can't find God is probably the reason that most bank robbers can't find a cop. They're not looking for one. So if people want to really find God, He's there and we can contact Him, or we can come in contact with Him. Now, let's look at the book of Acts, chapter 17, 24 through 27. Acts 17, 24 through 27. Any volunteers to read that? Anybody? 24 through what? Acts 17, 24 through 27.
The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in the temples built by human hands. And He does not serve by human hands, as if He needed anything, rather, He Himself gives everyone life and breathes and everything, and life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and that He marked out the appointed times of history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek Him and perhaps reach out for Him and find Him, though He is not far away from any one of us.
Okay, now, the main difference between Christianity and most other religions is this. In most religions, you have people seeking God, trying to come in contact with God, whereas in Christianity, it's the opposite. You have a God who's reaching out to mankind, wanting mankind to respond to Him. You guys have probably heard of D. Gordon Liddy. He was involved in the Watergate scandal years ago. And anyway, because of his activity and the crimes he committed in Watergate, he was sent to prison for 21 years. Also during that time, you probably heard of Chuck Colson. He was also involved in the Nixon administration. He also went to prison and did time. And while he was in prison, he was converted. And he became a spokesman for Christianity and apologist. And anyway, he died here a while back. He had a prison ministry that went all over the world and all that. But supposedly after he was, quote, converted, he was into prison, and he was visiting with G. Gordon Liddy. And when he was talking to G. Gordon Liddy, he was wondering if Liddy had become religious or not. And he asked him, he says, "Have you saw the light?" And J. Gordon Liddy supposedly said, "No, I'm not even looking for the switch." And most people today, rather than them really looking for God and trying to find God, they're not even looking. Now let's go to the book of Luke, chapter 15, verses 4 through 6. Luke 15, verses 4 through 6. I'll read that. Shows how God goes searching. Luke chapter 15, verses 4 through 6, but also look at verses 8 through 10. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost." Now look at 8 through 10. Or what person, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, Rejoice with me, for I have found a coin which I lost. In the same way, I tell you, there's joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So in this account here, we have an account of God, or the Father, of a parable here. Of course, it represents God, who he's looking for the lost. So God seeks after humanity and reveals himself to us. Now then, let's go back to the idea. We're talking about revelation. And there's two types of revelation, as I mentioned before. There's general revelation, and there's also special revelation. Would anybody care to explain the difference between the two? What is the difference between general revelation and special revelation? Anybody? Surprised nobody knows that one. Okay. Two types of revelation. There's general revelation. That is ways that God has revealed himself to all of humanity throughout all of time. Does that help anybody? What ways has God revealed himself to all of humanity throughout all of time?
Nature, all that he created, the perfection of it.
Through creation, that's good. That's part of it. See, special revelation, that doesn't apply to all humanity. Now, you've probably heard these arguments before, but we'll hit them briefly tonight. But God has revealed himself three areas to all of humanity. This is in general. Number one, he has revealed himself through creation. You guys may have heard of William Paley, who lived between 1723 and 1805. He made the argument that a watch requires a watchmaker. What's he saying? What do we mean by that? A watch demands a watchmaker. Any system of intelligence, there has to be someone behind it who was smarter than it. Okay? Now, you look at computers and what computers can do in our world. They're amazing, but they're still not as smart as a human because they can only program and put out what's been programmed into it. They can't think for themselves yet. Okay? So that's basically what we call the teleological argument for God's existence. It's basically any system of design must have a designer. Okay? Longfellow wrote, listen to what he said. He said that nature is a revelation of God, art a revelation of man. Now, what do you think he meant by that? He said that nature is a revelation of God, art a revelation of man. By this, Longfellow meant that just as the works of man reveal his abilities and power, so the universe displays the characteristics of God. Let's turn over to Romans 1, 19 and 20. Kurt, would you read that for us?
I'll back up verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse.
Okay, now, I may have mentioned this before, but I read a story one time that told about two people. It was an Arab and an atheist, and they were traveling through the desert. And anyway, that night, when they stopped for the night, start to rest, the Arab was a believer, and he sat down and started saying his prayers. And the atheist with him asked him, he says, you know, why do you speak to something that's invisible out there that you don't even know exists? And then this believer supposedly says, look there in the sand, what do you see? And there was tracks there. And the atheist says, well, that's camel tracks. He says, but you don't see a camel. He says, how do you know that a camel has been here? He says, well, I see his tracks. And at that point, the believer stood up and spread out his hands toward the skies and says, behold, the footprints of God referring to the whole universe. So that's the argument there. Let's look at Psalms 19, verse 1. Psalms 19, verse 1. I already have them almost there. chapter 19, verse 1. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. It was Sir William James, who was the famous British astronomer. He once said, "The universe appears to have been designed by a pure mathematician." I mean, look at the laws and all, and look at the eclipses and how the universe, how the earth and all, how it revolves in the solar system and all. I mean, there's certain guidance and there's laws there that guides all that, and there's someone behind that. Joseph Campbell wrote, he wrote, quote, "of a perception of a cosmic order mathematically definable," when he looked at the universe. Now, I think I may have, you probably heard this before, but imagine taking someone working in a print shop, and they're putting together a unabridged dictionary, and I forgot the word, and they've got it put together, but it explodes. What would the chances be of that dictionary falling back into place in perfect alphabetical order? Chances are not very good of that happening, is it? But that would be more probable for our universe, the way that it operates and all, and the design and all behind it, for it just to happen, but for nothing to cause it. So first of all, God reveals himself. As we just look at the universe, we should be able to look at that and come to the realization that there is something behind it, and it's God. Second of all, God reveals himself through intuition of a moral oughtness. And what do we mean by, what do I mean by that? God reveals himself through the intuition of a moral oughtness.
Of a moral what?
Moral oughtness, O-U-G-H-T. You ought to do something. Oughtness.
It's not English.
I think my English is bad. Is it that bad?
No, they understand it in Alabama.
That's basically called the moral law. Anytime, there's never been a society of people who has ever lived that didn't have some system of right and wrong. It may be twisted and perverted, but there's never been a generation or never been a group of people that has not had some type of law that they refer to. Now, look at animals. Do animals have that? You know, I've mentioned this before. I like to go out on YouTube. When I was a kid, I wanted to go on safari. I ran away from home going on safari, which I never made it. But anyway, I like to go on YouTube, and I like to watch these safaris or Africa shows, those wild animals, the lions and the buffalo and all that, fighting. And it's just brutal. But you see these lions, and they'll attack a little innocent baby buffalo or something, something that can't defend themselves. You go up into the Yellowstone and you watch the wolves kill a little baby elk or a little baby buffalo that's just defenseless. And you look at that, and what do you think? That's not right, that's not right. But those animals didn't cross their mind about it. So that's what separates us, one of the things that separates us from humanity, from animals. Now, one other thing. Speaking about this moral law, this oddness that we have within us, there's never been a society of people, anthropologists that studied, there's never been a group of people who weren't worshipers. Once again, they may worship the wrong thing, but anthropologists will tell you that they have never discovered a group of people yet who weren't worshipers. Look at animals. Do animals worship? So that goes back to this idea of this moral oughtness or the moral law. Okay? Now, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, he dignified the moral argument for God's existence more than any other philosopher. He argued that justice demanded a God and another life in order that right and wrong might be vindicated in the next life. Because in this life, many times you see wicked people who are never held accountable. And you see God-fearing, decent people who just basically get the hammer. Okay, so there's going to have to be a final judgment where people are held accountable. Now let's look at Ecclesiastes 12, verse 14. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 14. Anybody want to volunteer to read that?
God will judge us for everything we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad.
Okay, very good. Pythagoras, the Greek mathematician of the 6th century B.C., saw the plight of all man clearly when he said, quote, "It is not easy to know duties except man were taught them by God himself, or by some person who has received them from God, or obtained the knowledge of them through some divine means." Okay? You've all probably heard, I'm sure you have been referred to before, C.S. Lewis, just an absolute brilliant theologian and apologist. But one time he was an unbeliever, and he said that this moral ought is within humanity. He said that is what eventually turned his life around and caused him to leave skepticism and atheism to become a believer. Also, I mentioned Immanuel Kant earlier. Okay, this same argument is what caused him to turn from atheism, but even though he turned from atheism, he never did accept the scriptures as being inspired. But this same argument is what it was that turned their lives around. Okay, now, can you break God's laws, moral laws, without there being an accounting?
Perhaps in the short term.
Perhaps in the short term, you're probably right. But when there's a law, what happens? I've heard it said that man doesn't break God's laws, God's laws breaks man. Eventually, those laws end up catching up with you. Okay? Now, when it comes to morality, matter of fact, today we're seeing a lot on B7 morality today about same-sex marriage, and now we get the last thing the last few weeks about the controversy over dress restrooms and who can go where and what, and the confusion of all that. But we think that we can just basically liberalize, you know, bankrupt morally and it not catch up with us. But overall, look at our culture and look at our society. Look what it does to us long term. Matter of fact, go back and study the Greeks, study the Romans, and you'll find out in the very beginning of their civilization, for the Greeks and the Romans, divorce was almost unheard of. They had strong families and everything. But before the Greeks were destroyed and before the Romans were destroyed, what happened? Same pattern we're following today. They chose not to live according to moral laws, and guess what happened? They've been pushed aside by society. And the same thing would happen to us also if we don't turn around. Let's turn over to Proverbs 13, verse 15. Turn to Proverbs 13, verse 15. Does anyone here remember a guy named George Leonard? A few years ago, he was really involved in the promoting the sexual revolution years ago, and recently he has changed his views on immorality and the sexual revolution and all of that. He came to the conclusion, he said recently, he says, quote, "What I have learned is that there are no games without rules." And he goes on and quotes women who have become involved in free sex, free love, and all of that. And then he looks at all of the guilt and the problems and all that it brought in their lives. And he came to the conclusion that the emotional fruit that the sexual revelation has borne wasn't worthwhile. It wasn't what it was cut out to be. Does anyone here have a Proverbs 13, verse 15?
Good judgment wins favor, but the way of the unfaithful leads to their destruction.
Okay, there's always consequences that go with wrongdoing. Robert Brown wrote, "The sense within me that I owe a debt assures me somewhere must be somebody ready to take his due. All comes to this, where due is, their acceptance follows. Find him who accepts the due." Okay? Now, thirdly, God reveals himself last of all, in general, to all of humanity, through the laws of cause and effect. Through the laws of cause and effect, okay? Now, that's basically what some people refer to as the cosmological proof of the existence of God, which says there must be a primary cause or a primary mover. Things don't just happen. In other words, now, does anyone here ever study about perpetual motion machines? Anybody ever read about those? Give you a little bit of background on them. supposedly the Marquis of Worcester during the 17th century, he was rock in a castle. And while he was there, he would try to build a contraption that was a perpetual motion machine. And he demanded to see the king and show his invention to the king, and the king was so impressed with it that he allowed him to go free. And he hadn't really, the Marquis had not really written, hadn't really invented a perpetual motion machine. He had just invented something that simulated it. But anyway, for about 150 years back in those days, there was a period known as the period of the perpetual motion, where everybody was trying to build perpetual motion machines. There was even supposedly patents put out for them. But yet, even to this day, there's no one has built a perpetual motion machine that just runs for the sake of running. Why not? There has to be a primary mover, there has to be a cause, and there has to be an effect. Let's look at Colossians chapter 1. Let's look at Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17.
For in him were all things created, in the heavens and on the earth, things visible and things invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things have been created through him and unto him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist.
Now, think about this. Notice how knowledge has exploded the last few years, especially with technology and all. It's just amazing how it's accelerating, how fast, you know, things are changing. How do we come up and design the computers that we design, and some of the aircraft we design, and some of the technology, some of the things we do? How do we do that? How do we do that?
One step at a time.
One step at a time, but what's behind it?
Error.
Trial and error. Trial and error, what else?
Imagination.
Imagination, what else? There are basically certain laws that govern the universe, and what are we doing? In building these computers and all that, what are we doing? We're basically discovering what those laws are and harnessing them. The laws have been there all along. We're just now discovering them. But it's not like we're doing it on our own. The laws and all, and it's been there. We're just taking and developing it. Of course, God is the one that created it all, and he's behind it. Now, this idea of things not just happening, Benjamin Franklin, when he was in Paris, he was the ambassador of Paris. While he was there, he was a member of an elite group of people. And anyway, these people were pretty skeptical, and a lot of them were atheists and agnostics. And anyway, they were always kind of making fun of people who were believers. And supposedly one day, Benjamin Franklin had a little model of the universe. Not the universe, but the solar system. He had the sun and all the planets around the solar system, you know, in proportion to what they were supposed to be, had this little model. And he went into these people's, one of their offices one day. They were sitting there. He took that little model and he laid it on their desk. And one of them looked at him and says, "Who made that?" And Benjamin Franklin says, "Nobody, it just happened." See the point? Things like that, our universe and things like that don't just happen. There has to be something behind it. And of course, God is behind it. Now let's go to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Book of Genesis, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Anybody choose to read that?
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was without shape. Darkness was over the surface of the water, dwelling deep. But the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water. God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, so God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day and the darkness night. There was evening and there was morning, marking the first day.
Okay, now, we'll point something out. There's all types of theories about where the universe came from, how it began and all that. The laws and all that come into effect, or supposedly that caused the universe to come into effect. But when you still go back and look, there's not a better explanation than Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. I read a story one time told about a bunch of people who were scientists and all this, and they were trying to find the origin of the universe, or what was the most plausible explanation for the origin of the universe. Of course, you probably read and saw on TV some of the values and some of the views that they have toward it. But anyway, supposedly they have this computer, and they got all of their theories and everything else and entered it into this computer and pushed a button in the computer and did calculations and everything. And pretty soon, it spit out a reading as to how the universe came about. And the computer spit out the reading and it says, computer has no logical explanation. See Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. So when you look at all the explanations and all for our universe and all how it came into existence, it's hard to find anything that's a better explanation than Genesis chapter 1. Let's look at Hebrews 11, verse 3. Hebrews 11, verse 3, anybody?
By faith, we understand that the worlds prepared by the word of God, that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible.
Okay. Now, there's a well-known astrophysicist named Dr. Robert Jastrow, and he claims that the study of thermodynamics, as well as the study of radiation, proves that the universe had to have had a beginning. It could have been a big bang, but something had to have caused the big bang. Of course, anyway, he goes on, but he writes the following about the origin of the universe. He says, quote, "The scientists have been using their empirical tools for years, scaling the mountains of ignorance, and all of a sudden, they get to the last peak. They reach above to find their own personal answers, and when they're greeted, and there they're greeted by theologians who've been waiting for them for centuries." So basically, we looked at three ways that God has revealed himself to humanity. For all of humanity who's ever lived and still today, there's still three ways. There's three ways that he reveals himself in general in Revelation. What were those ways? In general Revelation, what were they?
Creation, moral law.
Yeah, moral law, oddness, okay. Creation, what else? What's the other one? Can't remember it myself.
Cause and effect, wasn't it?
Cause and effect. Now, those are three areas of just general revelation that God reveals himself to all kind of man. Now, there's nothing wrong with looking at those things, but just by looking at the things I've just described, does it tell a person how to be saved? It can get him looking maybe in the right direction. But in order for a person to understand God and to be saved, what does it take? It takes a step beyond that. Now, we can look at special revelation and general revelation somewhat like through friendship. Now, there's people that you're friends with, that you might work with and all, and you reveal to them certain things about yourself, certain things in general about yourself. You might reveal to them your age. You might reveal to them your occupation. Surface level stuff. But then there's other people that you might consider a special friend, maybe like family member, your mate, or something like that. How do you reveal yourself to them? Is it on a superficial level? So when it comes to special revelation, that's when God reveals himself more than just the superficial three ways we mentioned before. Now, look at Adam and Eve. When they were in the Garden of Eden, they could come to the realization that God was there through the things we discussed. But in order for them to have a deeper relationship with him, what was required? What happens? Let's go to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verses 28 and 29. Genesis, chapter 1, verse 28 and 29. I'll begin 27 and 28 and 29. "And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed in its own seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you. So what does God do? He starts communicating with humanity, okay? That's what we would call the first step in special revelation. General revelation doesn't tell man what he must do to be saved, for a special revelation is what it takes for man to learn to be saved. John Calvin, the famous theologian and reformer, aptly illustrated the necessity of special revelation for man to read the book of nature correctly when he stated, quote, just as old or bleary-eyed men and those with weak vision, if you thrust before them a most beautiful volume, even if they recognize it to be some sort of writing, yet can scarcely construe two words, but with the aid of spectacles will begin to read distinctly. So Scripture, gathering up the otherwise confused knowledge of God in our minds, having dispersed our dullness, clearly shows us the true God. Now let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty of God on high. Time's almost up. I'm not going to go all the way to 8. I'll read a comment, then we'll conclude with a prayer. There was an old leader in the 3rd century known for his wisdom. And he was asked how he got the wisdom that he had. And he explained his wisdom the following way. He says, quote, the source of all that I have learned is in the two books. The one is outwardly small, the other is very large. The former has many pages, the latter only two. The pages of the former are white with many black letters on them. One of the pages of the big book is blue, and the other is green. On the blue page, there is one big golden letter and many small silver ones. On the green page, there are innumerable colored letters in red, white, yellow, blue, and gold. The small book is the Bible. The large one is nature. These two books belong together. We got through basically general revelation tonight. Next week we'll get into special revelation. We'll get into inspiration and so forth and get into that more detail. But we'll close it out for tonight. We're a little bit early, but we'll close it out there. Who has the closing prayer after? Yes.
When we're talking about the three areas of general revelation there at the beginning, when we get all said and done with that, all that does is
it kind of points you in the right direction.
Well, it provides you with the understanding that you have a need.
Right.
It doesn't answer that need, but it makes you aware of it.
Absolutely. That sums up exactly what I was trying to say the whole time.
Well, it took me 30 seconds.
He really makes me feel good about this. Who's got the closing prayer? Okay, Gerald.